Welcome to Today in Focus. Today, we bring you part four of a mini-series into the case of the Freshwater Five, men sentenced to a combined total of 104 years in prison for a conspiracy to import £53 million worth of cocaine. They say they're innocent. In this series, we delve into the evidence as two of the men prepare to go to the Court of Appeal in what is likely to be their best chance to clear their name. If this is the first day you're coming to this, I encourage you to scroll down your feed and start with part one that was published on Friday. Parts two and three came out over the weekend, and then listen to this episode. I promise it will be worth it. The way I see it, there are two key moments in this case. One of them is what happened at 1853, up on the cliffs at Tennyson Down. The police see something being thrown over the side of the Galwad, and later they amend the logs. Everything we talked about in the previous episode that was considered by the jury in the original trial. The other key moment was about 17 hours before that, in the middle of the English Channel. A 3.5 minute period not long after midnight. At 34 minutes past midnight, GMT, to be precise. The period when the prosecution says that after the drugs were thrown from the container ship, the Oriane, they were scooped from the sea by the Galwad. At the risk of stating the obvious, those 3.5 minutes are pretty crucial. Because if the drugs were on the Oriane, like the prosecution say they were, then this is the only time the men could have taken them. Those 3.5 minutes are what this episode is about. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, Freshwater Part 4, Radar. At trial, the prosecution expert tried to make it easier for everybody by drawing a chart. An Admiralty chart, like a map of the English Channel. He printed it out really big and put it up in the courtroom for everyone to see. On the chart, there were two lines that really mattered. There was a purple line, which was where the Galwad had been, and a red one, which was for the Oriane. Each line was based on its own source of data. The data for the Galwad came from something called an Olex machine.
The Olex machine is an amazing piece of fishing kit. It really is like a sort of camera of the sea. It is representational, it's pixelated. It actually looks a bit like Minecraft, come to think of it. But it's a pixelated image of the seafloor showing the different levels, which is exactly what lobster and crab fishermen need to know whether that's a good spot to chuck your pots off. So that device not only shows you what's under the water, it tells you exactly where you are on the Earth's surface. The Olex has recorded every movement that the Galwad made. And the key here is that it's laying down a recording of position every 4 seconds, which enables you to draw a little kind of snail trail of where the Galwad has been with considerable precision.
An Olex machine is widely regarded as pretty accurate. And throughout this whole case, nobody has ever disputed exactly where the Galwad went on the night in question. Not at trial and not now. For the red line on the chart, the Oriane's line, they use something called AIS.
The snail trail for the Oriane as she proceeded up the channel was from the Oriane's own AIS broadcast. So the boat is telling you where it is. It's a message generated by that boat saying, this is where I am. That message goes up to the satellite, and the satellite then distributes that message to anyone who wants to receive it, who wants to know where that boat is.
The AIS message went from the English Channel up into space and came back down to a shore base station where it was recorded. And from there, it ended up in the hands of the prosecution expert. The thing about the AIS data, according to Emily, is that it was much less zoomed in than the information they had for the Galwad. Instead of having a position every 4 seconds, for the Ariane, there were long gaps.
There was a dot available at 0026 hours, and there was another dot at 0038 hours, but there was a gap in the data, so an 11-minute gap between 0026 and 0038. And what the prosecution expert did was draw a straight line as the crow flies between those two dots from point A to point C.
So like I said, you've got a map and two lines drawn on it, one purple, one red. One is the Galwad, the other the Ariane. At first, the boats are far apart. But as you move across the page, they get closer and closer until they cross. The Galwad crosses over where the Ariane had just been. It crosses over its wake. And something the prosecution says is critical. The Galwad slows down. This is the key moment.
That crossing was at the heart of the prosecution's case at trial. They emphasised very strongly that that was the moment at which the Galwad collected drugs thrown off the Ariane.
Obviously, the Freshwater Five denied this very strongly at trial. They accepted the data that showed they'd cross paths, but they said they were in a busy shipping lane and they slowed down only to map the seabed with their Rolex machine. Something they had done at other times during the same trip and in many trips before. And they said there's no evidence that there were ever any drugs on the Ariane in the first place. They said, okay, that's your theory, but you have no proof. And that is true. The judge in the original trial said there was no evidence to substantiate that the drugs had come from the Ariane. The police did search the Ariane later when it docked in the UK, and they never found any trace of drugs. Although, to be fair, it is not easy to search a huge ship with thousands of containers. But at the trial, it was accepted by both sides that the Galwad crossed the Ariane's wake and that the two boats were close together for a short period of time that night. Once that has been accepted, the next question was whether it would have been possible to move the drugs from one boat to the other. The prosecution said yes. Their expert, a master mariner, said it was possible to throw the drugs into the sea and avoid the Ariane's huge propellers. He thought that if the holdalls had lights on, the crew of the Galwad would have been able to find them in the sea and drag them aboard. He didn't make out that any of this would be easy, but he said, it's possible. The defence had an expert who was a specialist in small boats, a guy who spends a lot of time at sea, in the dark apparently, teaching military personnel how to intercept larger vessels. And he disagreed with the prosecution expert quite strongly. He considered a few scenarios. First, he argued that the holdalls could not have been tied together when they were thrown from the Ariane because they would have immediately ripped apart when they hit the water. And they can't have been bundled up because they would have been impossible to lift, leaving only one option. If this unfolded, as the prosecution said, then 11 separate holdalls must have been thrown off one by one. Could they be retrieved in the dark? The defence expert said, and I quote, "When I first saw this suggestion, I could not help being very amused because for somebody to try and retrieve even one rucksack in a period of 3.5 minutes is virtually impossible. It simply absolutely cannot be done." When we spoke to Danny Payne, one of the men on board that night, he felt pretty much the same way.
No. But yeah, I mean, if you go down to the seaside on the Forsyth Gale and just see, you know, how rough and windy, and then think, put yourself on a boat out there, and then you've got to try and grab something. Well, how are you going to grab it? You know, laughable. It's laughable.
You know Martin we heard from in part two, a really experienced crab and lobster fisherman from Cornwall. I put this to him too. How hard is it to pull objects out of the sea in the dark in bad weather?
Very, very difficult. Yeah.
Right.
Very difficult.
And in this case, the prosecution is saying there's 11 hold doors in the sea, and they say they're all separate, not attached together. And then they say this lobster fishing boat picks them out in 3.5 minutes in the dark.
That takes some believing. That takes some believing. It's totally impossible to pick up 11 objects in 3 minutes in a gale of wind.
After thinking about our conversation, Martin later messaged me to say you'd struggle to do that in 15 minutes. Ultimately, of course, the jury found the men guilty. But what if the Galwad never crossed behind the Oriane?
When I first started looking at the navigation evidence in this case, the moment where these two tracks of these two vessels cross is obviously visually a very compelling piece of evidence. It's kind of like, do you remember from OJ, if the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit? It seemed that in this case, the prosecution were arguing that if those tracks crossed, those men smuggled those drugs. So I started to focus in on this part of the navigation evidence and try to understand it. But I've got to say, I've got to confess, it took me months. As a landlubber, it's very difficult to look at a static diagram of vessel movements and actually work out who's crossing in front or behind whom.
One of the first things Emily needed to do was get hold of the underlying data that the prosecution expert used to draw his red line on the chart for the Oriane. But it was something else that really caught her attention. Something that was disclosed at trial, but that Emily says was not the focus. A handwritten note in a log. Don't hate me. I'm about to introduce a third boat, the HMC Vigilant. The Vigilant is what is called a cutter. It belongs to the UK Border Agency. Imagine a big grey metal boat with really tall antennas protruding from the deck, full of high-tech equipment. Well, it was out in the English Channel that night too, helping with Operation Disorient, the police operation that night. And it had a radar on board.
It's someone's job to write down what's going on. They write down what's going on operationally, but they also write down what their instruments are telling them. And there was a very kind of minor notation in the Vigilant's log that was disclosed at trial that showed what purported to be a radar position, so a position recorded on the Vigilant's radar for the Oriane at 0030, so right around the time that this supposed interaction between the fishing boat and the container ship took place.
The time of that note is really important, and not just because it is exactly when the drugs were said to have been passed from one boat to the other, but also because it is slap bang in the middle of that 11-minute gap in the data used by the prosecution to map the exact journey of the Oriane that night. Emily looked at it, and something seemed off. But she wasn't sure. So to start with, she asked Jamie, who, having spent his life at sea, was used to looking at maps like this.
So I ended up asking if I could get him into the prison, through legitimate means, of course, some of the kind of chart work instruments that you need in order to plot marine navigation positions across a chart. And he started trying to plot the positions that he was seeing on these documents. So he was taping bits of paper together to keep plotting the positions. And the pieces of paper were getting longer and longer and longer, all taped together. And eventually, I think he had to be allowed to use the prison gym in order to lay all this material out as he was attempting to piece together what these data sets were telling us.
And when he looked at what was on this huge reel of paper, Jamie could point out what wasn't right.
It was at that point I realised that we absolutely needed a fresh expert view on this. So I took the data that provided the positions for the Oriane, and I also gave him this handwritten radar position that the Vigilant had recorded for the Oriane. I didn't tell him the names of the boats. I didn't tell him anything about the case. I just gave him the data sets and said, please plot these. And when he plotted these data sets, the lines no longer crossed.
So what Emily is saying is that before, we had the Ariane moving from A to C, with an information gap in between. Now we've got A, B and C, with the handwritten radar position in the middle. And this kind of bends the line for the Ariane further south, so that the tracks of the Ariane and the Galwad no longer cross. This handwritten note was Emily's first clue that there might be radar evidence that would point towards the innocence of the five men. Because, to her, it suggested that the Galwad couldn't have collected the drugs because it never came close enough to where the Ariane had been. How did you feel when you saw that for the first time?
It felt like one of those moments where the parameters of the case change because suddenly you can no longer trust what was presented at trial. Whether or not these two tracks crossed is not as cut and dried as it was presented as being at trial. That's when your ears really prick up. That was the first moment where I became confident that we had fresh evidence that we could take to the Criminal Cases Review Commission to persuade them to really investigate this case.
So let me tell you quickly about the Criminal Cases Review Commission. It was set up in the aftermath of the Guildford 4 and Birmingham 6 cases.
4:10, the first steps to freedom, the roar of the crowd ringing round the Old Bailey.
When the UK was going through a bit of a miscarriage of justice crisis.
For 16 and a half years, we have been deployed, used as political scapegoats for people in there at the highest. The police told us from the start that they knew we hadn't done it. They told us they didn't care who'd done it. They told us that we were selected and that they were going to frame us.
The idea is that they investigate cases. Sometimes they uncover new information. And if they think there's enough to merit a case, they send it directly to the Court of Appeal. So if you think you've been wrongfully convicted in the UK, in theory, the CCRC is your best hope. Now that Emily had this new evidence, she asked the CCRC to look at the case. And there was one thing in particular that she really needed. So they had this handwritten radar position. But the person who wrote that was simply noting down what the instruments on the Vigilant were telling them. They were just writing down what they were seeing on the screen at that moment. But what if the whole data set still existed? If so, there would be a record of everything that the Vigilant's radar picked up that night.
The Commission has the power, statutorily, to demand access to information from any state entity. So that UKBA radar data, the Commission could access it. So we took an application to the Commission saying, hey, look at this. Not only are there all sorts of problems with the observations in Freshwater Bay, but look at this mid-channel stuff. Look, please investigate this. Use your powers to go out and get the information. And for 3 years, they were reviewing the case. During that time, I think I was having a sort of gradual leakage of faith in the CCRC actually doing their job. So when I first submitted that application, we were, you know, so optimistic. Over the months, and then the months turned to years, it became clear that actually they weren't following up on these leads. And I would email them again and again and again. We had phone calls with them. Council and I went up to Birmingham to meet with them, to present the material. And I just started to lose faith that they were actually doing the investigation that was required.
Sounds like you felt you were banging your head against a brick wall.
Oh, Anushka, that's my life. That's this job. Banging my head against a brick wall is what all of us at Appeal are doing most of the time, is what it feels like. And that brick wall is access to evidence.
And so this must have felt huge for you because the CCRC was your main hope to get to the Court of Appeal. Tell me about where you were when you heard their decision.
Oh, I was sitting in a Fiat Panda in a car park outside a prison in the northwest of England, having just visited a prisoner in a completely different case. And I hopped into my car and fired up my laptop to just check whether there were any fires I needed to put out before getting back on the road and driving for hours and hours to my next place. And I saw an email had come from CCRC and I saw the subject line. And you, in those moments, you take a deep breath before you click, don't you? You want to know the answer, but at the same time, could you just have a few more minutes of not knowing the answer just in case it's the wrong answer? And I double clicked and it was the wrong answer. And I knew instantly. I can just remember the sort of draining feeling at that moment throughout my body. They were not going to send the case to the Court of Appeal. And what's more, it was clear from the decision that they had not accessed any of this material. They had not got this radar data from the Vigilant that we'd asked for, along with all the other materials that we'd asked them to get. They had simply not done the investigation that statutorily they're the body that can do it. So the CCRC, in my view, completely dropped the ball. They did not investigate the case. And then, unsurprisingly, they concluded that there was no fresh evidence with which to refer it to the Court of Appeal. So if you don't ask, you won't get. And if you don't get, you then don't have what you need to refer the case. And I guess I took a few minutes to kind of compose myself. And then you have to just get on with it. You have to get back on the bike. And of course, the next step is letting the prisoners and the families know what's happened. And so I sat in that car park in the rain and made those phone calls.
What was that like, speaking to them?
It was horrible. It was absolutely horrible. Frankly, if it had been me, and I suspect if it had been you, Anushka, getting this news from your lawyer, I would have had a thing or two to say. I would be screaming. I would be screaming the house down at the injustice of the situation. But they were so forbearing with us and kind. Obviously, they were devastated, but they were also ready to get back in the saddle and keep fighting. So it was bad. But at the same time, there was no way we were stopping. No way.
We asked the CCRC for the full statement of reasons in this case, and they didn't give it to us. But one argument they made was that the defence had presented in the original trial a persuasive argument that this handover of drugs could never have happened in the way the prosecution set out. And yet the jury convicted the men anyway. But, as Emily says, they didn't seek the fresh evidence that she believes is key. Coming up, what does a discovery of floppy disks locked away at the back of a safe mean for the Freshwater Five?
We thought the CCRC would get access to the evidence to build the case, to make it stronger in front of the Court of Appeal. And so I advised that we should wait for the CCRC to do their job. At the end of those 3 years, they said no. And so then we decided to go direct to the Court of Appeal on behalf of Danny and on behalf of John.
Now, 7 years since five men on the Isle of Wight were convicted of one of the biggest drug smuggling hauls in British history. The families of the so-called Freshwater Five have long claimed that their husbands and fathers were victims of a miscarriage of justice. Tonight, legal efforts are underway to seek leave to appeal for two of those men.
Let me just quickly explain something. In England and Wales, you usually only get one chance to go directly to the Court of Appeal. Jamie, Zoran and Scott used their appeal pretty much straight after the initial trial. But Danny and John didn't. So this appeal is about their convictions. But if their convictions are quashed, then all of the men's are likely to be. Danny and John launched their appeal in 2018. And at first, the appeal was based on similar evidence to that had been previously provided to the CCRC, including that handwritten note that appeared to place the Oriane in a different position than put forward by the prosecution in the original trial. But Emily was still obsessed with getting the whole data set from the Vigilance radar. And with the case now in front of the Court of Appeal, she says the CPS responded to her disclosure requests, including for the radar data from the Vigilant.
I think that when an appeal, it's got a case number, people started to reply to my emails. And that was, you know, that was a change. So when actually asking for access to evidence, I was getting responses. The response was usually no, but at least, you know, I was getting a no. So that meant that we could keep pushing. We knew who to engage with. So getting hold of that radar data suddenly became something that was within our grasp.
And by then, Emily had figured out where the data was being held.
The radar data that we were after was stored by the prosecution's engineering expert, who is the guy who went on board the vessels and downloaded data from them. Both he got the data from the OLEX and he got the data from the Vigilant. And bless him, I mean, this man is the hero of the case. He had stored that data in the back of a safe on floppy disks. So the data wasn't lost. We were allowed to access it. And how that happened was the CPS said to the trial engineering expert, you may give those floppy disks to a courier who's going to come and collect them. And that courier, you know, I'm not allowed to touch them. CPS is not allowed to touch them. I mean, this was really, you know, like proper logistics. That courier came down to the office of the engineering expert. The engineering expert went into the back of his safe and got out the disks, and courier took them securely back to the laboratory where those floppy disks were opened. And goodness me, I mean, when the floppy disks were at the forensics laboratory waiting to be copied, I mean, that was an anxious moment. Because obviously, you know that these things can degrade. But they confirmed that the data was intact and that they were able to copy it. And they made a copy and they provided one of those copies to the prosecution trial expert and one of the copies to the expert that we were consulting in post-conviction proceedings. So now the data was available.
So literally that little bit of information that you desperately needed had been locked up at the back of a safe.
Yes, locked up in the back of a safe by an expert who was employed by the police to gather and preserve data in this case. We provided it to the marine electronics expert that we were consulting, and he had to get it to play, if you can imagine, on an old computer running old software. And then he was finally able to kind of open it up and have the screen running with the software that would have been running on the night on, you know, back in 2010, and see what it showed and see where the vessels were.
And this felt huge for the defence. They still had the Galwad's track from the OLEX device, that little fishing computer, and that hadn't changed. The prosecution is still using AIS data. This AIS data still shows the Galwad and the Oriane coming really close together. Until their paths just about touch. But now, thanks to the floppy disks, there is a third source of data. Radar. And it gave an alternative version of where the Oriane was on the night in question. And if you compare that to where the Galwad was, the paths never cross. It confirms what the handwritten note had suggested. If this radar data is right, the Galwad never goes over the Oriane's wake. In fact, the defence will say that the two boats, according to radar, never came closer than 448 metres, while their two tracks never closer than 165.
That was a big moment because the evidence at trial had been completely uncontested by the defence. They had no reason to consider that the prosecution expert's diagram might be wrong. They had no reason to consider that there might be evidence hidden in the back of a safe that would enable them to challenge the prosecution expert's account. So it's significant both in terms of getting closer to figuring out what really happened, but it's also legally significant because it was not shared with the defence. So that in itself is a legal issue for the appeal.
Now what we've got is a contest. A marine navigational data arm wrestle between two versions of where the Oriane was. The prosecution is likely to say that the AIS data is more accurate than the radar data. The defence is going to argue that there was a problem with the accuracy of the Oriane's AIS and that the radar is more trustworthy. The question is whether all of this leaves us with enough doubt to question whether the Galwad came close enough to the Oriane's track for the handover to happen.
The ultimate resolution of these issues is for the Court of Appeal to decide. And these are very complex matters that experts are getting into in great detail. But from a purely layperson's point of view, it's pretty clear that the evidence is different to what it was at trial and that that could have made a difference to the jury.
If the radar is right, could the Galwadi Mór still have picked up the drugs?
We have a new expert who specialises in smaller vessels and how you move items or people on or off those smaller vessels at sea. And he has concluded that no, if the radar line is correct, the Galwad could not have collected the drugs. The distances are too great. It's not that the drugs could have naturally drifted over to the Galwadi Mór over the gap between the two tracks. A marine laboratory has looked at this and done some modelling at our request and have concluded that the direction anything jettisoned from the Oriane would have floated in is away from the Galwadi Mór.
Of course, the prosecution will put forward their own experts in court this week, making their own arguments. But that isn't the end of the story when it comes to the radar data.
One of the things that frustrates me so hugely about the regime for accessing evidence in this country is that you're not allowed to access a piece of police evidence like these discs in the back of the safe unless you can say what it is that that piece of evidence will say that helps your case. Okay, so the catch-22 is we could not access those discs unless we could say what was on them that might help our case. So we said, we think, because of this squiggly little handwritten note from the radar data that was on the vigilant log, we said, we think that on those discs is something that will show that the Oriane is further south. And so we were allowed to access the data. But what a regime that says you can only see something if you can say what it's going to say doesn't allow for is the unknown unknowns, the surprises. And investigation of wrongful convictions is all about the surprises. It's all about the unknown unknowns. When we got the radar data in this case, not only did it show that the tracks of the vessels didn't cross according to the radar readings from the Vigilant, it also had other bits of radar data. And these really are, I mean, as our experts kind of got those floppy disks open and got the data playing on this old computer that he'd set up to use the old out-of-date software. Not only could he see information about whether the tracks crossed or not, he could also see other radar targets, not just the Oriane, but other radar targets through the course of the voyage of the Vigilant.
So, unlike the static charts used at trial, Emily says that now she could see everything that could be seen from the Vigilant's radar on the night in question, but also the next day. And it's late afternoon the next day that you'll remember two police officers say they see the Galwad in Freshwater Bay throwing the drugs overboard. And just a few minutes later, something interesting happens on the radar.
You can see the Galwad noodling around, going up and down mackerel fishing in the bay and then disappearing around the needles. You can see her as a radar target. But then, just as she disappears around the needles, another little dot, little blob, radar blob appears and comes over the cliffs and flies over Freshwater Bay up the track that the Galwad had just taken. And we concluded that that's got to be a plane because it's been on the cliffs, now it's in the sea.
Emily says that blob that her experts say appears to be behaving like a surveillance plane flew over the area just minutes after the clifftop officers saw items being thrown off the Galwad.
What this new radar evidence showed us is there was an aircraft up. And if that plane had seen anything in the water, it would have reported it in. We would have heard about that. That evidence would have been presented at trial. But it wasn't.
We don't know what the prosecution will say about this in court this week. But Emily says that it was assumed at trial that there was no aircraft that would be able to check out the clifftop officer's observations. The prosecution did accept at trial that the police were using a surveillance plane as part of their operation that night. But they said that it didn't take off from the nearby airport in Bournemouth until 7 p.m. So it couldn't have been in the Freshwater Bay area at 6:53 p.m. It was still on the ground. But the defence is going to challenge that tomorrow through a fresh piece of documentary evidence. Emily says that she's got hold of a draft statement to the police watchdog, the Independent Office for Police Complaints. She says it includes a line that is missing in the final statement, suggesting the plane could have taken off earlier, from 6:40 p.m. And that's potentially important because it would allow time for the plane to be overhead minutes after the drugs were said to be dumped. The defence will argue this is further evidence of the jury being misled because it adds weight to their suggestion that the radar blobs flying over the cliff were indeed a police plane. Is it not possible, Emily, that even if it was a police plane overhead, that it wouldn't have seen the drugs in the water?
That is precisely the argument that the prosecution is presenting. So they're saying, even if it was, you can't assume it could have seen the drugs in the water. However, there is footage from the following day, filming from quite a distance, and it can see the drugs in the water. The rope, it practically stands out like neon against the surface of the sea.
Right. So that's two arguments that the defence will be raising at the appeal as they try to challenge key elements of the prosecution's version of events. First, the idea that the Oriane flung the drugs into the sea to be scooped up by the Galwad. The defence says the radar data suggests the boats never crossed tracks. Second, the prosecution claim that the men threw the drugs into the water at Freshwater Bay in order to check the coast was clear of police before returning to pick them up. The defence says, hang on, here's evidence of a surveillance plane in the area minutes later. Why didn't it see the drugs? And that's not all. There's one final piece to the jigsaw that they say creates a very different picture.
The discs from the back of the safe have yielded even more evidence. And this, again, is an unknown unknown. This is something that wasn't predicted, but it's there. And that is that after the Galwad's gone around the Needles, and it's just as she comes into Yarmouth Harbour, so the Vigilant's heading in towards the Needles, and suddenly on radar, within a nautical mile of her, ahead of her, pops up a target. And this boat, which transpires to be a small, very fast boat, moves along in front of the Vigilant for a few minutes, and then suddenly zips off to the east, and it's heading, if you draw a kind of line, a vector straight out from that course, it goes straight to where the drugs are recovered the following morning.
The Vigilant continues on its way, apparently following the Galwad's route back to Yarmouth. So while the other boat is speeding towards the place the drugs will be found the next day, it drops out of radar sight a few kilometres from the actual spot. Although at its last recorded speed of 35 knots, it could have been there in a matter of minutes, according to the defence.
So, of course, our first question was, is this a law enforcement boat going to check out the site of the alleged 6 or 7 items overboard at intervals? Again, something that would make total sense, right? You know, this is called in, drug suspect, chuck something in, see, go and have a look at what it is with a plane. Can't see anything. Let's just be absolutely sure there's nothing there. Let's send in a boat as well. So off goes the boat. That's one scenario.
The prosecution aren't speaking to us ahead of this hearing, but we understand that they say there is nothing in their records to suggest it's a police boat.
Which leaves us with only one other conclusion, which is this is a suspect vessel. And again, this is something that actually makes sense of an aspect of the case that has always flummoxed us, which is why on earth would you drop £52 million worth of cocaine on a bank holiday weekend in broad daylight under Tennyson Monument, a well-known sightseer spot, where you could actually be seen? Surely you'd have to be in a bit of a panic to be doing that. Like, that's a kind of crazy thing to do. So if this is an alternate suspect boat, then the scenario that you can then envisage is that it's a boat with £52 million worth of cocaine on board it that sees over its shoulder, there's the Vigilant bearing down on me, less than a nautical mile behind me. I'll just potter along here. No, that's still the Vigilant. She's getting a bit closer. Right, I'm out of here. Panic and dump. It's the panic and dump scenario. So this speedboat, you could argue, is then travelling, dashing away from the Vigilant to a location where it then just dumps the drugs because it doesn't want to get caught with them on board. So again, we ask the prosecution, okay, so you're saying it's not a law enforcement vessel. So it's an alternate suspect then. That's, you know, I mean, look, it's going to the position where the drugs were found. Surely this is what it is. And again, we get a carefully worded answer to say that there's nothing in the documentation to suggest that this is an alternate suspect.
By now, we've gone through all the evidence. We've heard about Austin and Dujic. We've heard about how Zoran came to the UK, how John Beer picked them up. We've heard about Phones for You and the burner phones. We've heard about those phone calls in the middle of the night. We've also heard about the clifftop evidence. What do you think this evidence means for everything else we've heard so far?
What the court has to do is it has to assess the safety of the conviction. And the prosecution will assert that the conviction is still safe because even if you take out the clifftop officer's evidence, the convictions are safe because there was an Eastern European on the boat, because there were phone calls between that Eastern European and his land-based fixer, and because the people accused when they were arrested told some lies at interview. But that evidence can now be seen in a whole different light. So they say there are phone calls being made at around the time that the Galwad crossed the track of the Ariane. Well, the radar evidence suggests that the Galwad didn't cross the track of the Ariane. The phone calls were of evidentiary significance at trial because they were said to coincide with an event, and that event was the crossing of the tracks of the two vessels. If the tracks don't cross, the significance of the phone calls is hugely diminished, and you return to the innocent explanation that they gave at trial of why those phone calls were taking place. And then the lies at interview, so, you know, the prosecution says, oh, well, you know, Jamie and Dan didn't say that Scott was on board the boat. That looks really shifty. Look, at this point, you can kind of see the point of that lie. Jamie has made the point that he didn't want Scott to get caught up in something that he thought was going to just blow over. It didn't blow over. It's more than 10 years later. And I guess Jamie's instinct to protect Scott has been borne out by what happened, because Scott ended up serving 6.5 years in prison for a crime he maintains he didn't commit.
And now we're days out from the appeal. How do you feel?
Oh, I'm exhausted. I'm totally exhausted. This close to an appeal hearing, I'm practically cross-eyed with tiredness. But I think the evidence that has, you know, been extracted like pulling hen's teeth from the authorities in this case has really come together, and it's fresh. No one's arguing that this material was available before. It's fresh. And so it's now for the court to decide whether it would have made a difference to the jury.
Next time, in the final episode of Freshwater, what is at stake for the men and their families as the Court of Appeal begins its hearing? As I've mentioned, we did ask the Crown Prosecution Service for an interview, but they said they did not want to speak ahead of tomorrow's hearing. We also went to the Criminal Cases Review Commission, the CCRC, the public body that investigates potential miscarriages of justice cases. They said that there was a 78-page statement of reasons about why they did not refer the Freshwater 5 case to the Court of Appeal. They said they couldn't share it with us legally, but that they only refer where the statutory test is met, describing that as a real possibility based on new evidence or argument that the Court of Appeal will overturn the conviction. They also said that where an applicant has not previously appealed, there must be exceptional circumstances to justify the CCRC's involvement instead of a direct appeal. They said they respectfully disagreed with Emily Bolton's criticisms and did not consider them an accurate reflection of the CCRC, adding that they carried out a careful and thorough review of these cases, meeting with lawyers for the men on two occasions, considering extensive submissions, as well as using their powers to obtain a large amount of relevant material. They said it was their role to decide which materials needed to be considered, and they were an independent public body, not obliged to accede to every request made by an applicant or their representatives. They said deciding whether to pursue particular lines of inquiry had to be finely balanced against whether it would reasonably give rise to a real possibility that the conviction will be overturned. That's it for today. I do hope you are enjoying this series. If you are, then we'd really appreciate it if you would review us and rate us wherever you listen to your podcasts, and do tell friends about it. You can also tweet me at Anushka Astana. Also, check out The Observer's Home Affairs editor, Mark Townsend's reporting on this. He wrote about the case yesterday, and you can read it all at theguardian.com, where you can also find a great long read by Anna Moore from April last year called Five Fishermen, A Stormy Night and £53 million of Cocaine. Were the Freshwater Five wrongly convicted? This series is produced by Josh Kelly. Sound design and original music is by Axel Cucutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow with the final part of this series.